Space, time, and matter. The mysterious forces of nature. What is gravity? All the symbols representing all the elements around us. Bright lines known as theoretical physicists. Everything falls to Earth with the same acceleration.
To welcome you here this evening, it's nice to see so many people, as always, who are showing up so regularly for our events. We're very, very pleased to be able to interact with the community in this way, and we're even more pleased that the community has responded in such numbers. So we're delighted to have you here. We're delighted to have Professor Jana Levin here as well this evening. Let me tell you a little bit more about her. Professor Levin is a professor at Barnard College at Columbia University. She received her Bachelor of Arts at that very college and her PhD in theoretical physics from MIT. She is, as I said, a faculty member at Barnard College with wide-ranging interests in cosmology and astrophysics. She has written two books. The first book she wrote was called How the Universe Gets Its Spots and was a very unique and interesting expostulation of cosmology and modern physics, as well as being an opportunity for her to elucidate her original views on the finiteness of the universe. And she has written a second book, most recently, called A Madman Dreams of Turing Machines, all about Kurt Gödel and Alan Turing, and she's going to have the opportunity to talk to you about that this evening. So ladies and gentlemen, Professor Jana Levin.
Thank you for that introduction. This is a great crowd. It's so nice to see such a great crowd. I'm hoping this will turn out to be the greatest of all pleasures. Not that I'm aiming high or anything. I am talking about this book that I wrote called A Madman Dreams of Turing Machines. This is kind of an experiment for me talking about it in this way. It's going to be part science lecture, sort of part reading, maybe. I might actually do a little reading. And the reason why is that this book is classified as a novel. And that was a strange decision for us. We labored for a long time after the book was written as to whether or not to call this fiction or nonfiction. It very much sits on the boundary between the two, that kind of strange place between the two. And as we talk more about some of the ideas that inspired this book, it might not seem so odd that it sits on that boundary, because a lot of these ideas are about truth and about mathematical truth. It's about what's fact, not really what's fiction, but what we can know and the limits of our knowledge. And so it seemed like an interesting experiment to try to write a fictionalized story. So I'll tell you a little bit about that. The characters in this book are Kurt Gödel, who you may or may not have heard of. He's not as well known as the other character, Alan Turing. Kurt Gödel was most influential in 1931 when he published a paper on the incompleteness of mathematics. He was living in Vienna. He was 25 years old, very young, very promising student, clearly brilliant, but very reticent, didn't really socialize much. He was sort of an odd character, but he was clearly brilliant, and he was involved with a lot of the great thinkers in Vienna at the time. And he published a very important paper on the limits of mathematical knowledge. And I'll talk a little bit about why that was so shocking. I'll try to make it personal for why it was shocking for me, for why it sort of haunted me. The other person is Alan Turing, who's a bit more famous. Turing is well known for having cracked the German Enigma code. People might have heard of him in that context. When he was a young student, or rather a fellow, at Cambridge University, war broke out, and even though he was sort of apolitical and once went to an anti-war protest, he didn't really know who he was or where he was in the political spectrum of things. He was a problem solver. He loved to solve problems. He was another truly eccentric character. And over at High Table, I don't know if you know about High Table, in Cambridge at the colleges, there's one table where the elite sit and discuss great ideas, and they all feel very proud of themselves. And Alan Turing sat at High Table, but he was, again, a person who was not socially that well equipped. I think you would describe Alan Turing as somebody who had Asperger's syndrome, which you may have heard of. He was sort of a highly functioning autistic, although at the time, it wasn't diagnosed as that, because Asperger, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name just right, was a Viennese psychologist who was just then coming up with his ideas and just then framing or diagnosing this condition. But clearly Turing was one of those people. He talked too loudly. He didn't know how to modulate the rhythm of his voice properly. He always missed the emotional current in a room. He couldn't really gauge people's faces. He was lost in social situations. This was a kind of upper-class Englishman. It was not an advantage to be lost in social situations. And, you know, there is a certain English reserve, and in an odd way, Turing didn't have any of that. He was blunt, he was honest, he was very forthright. Not that the English aren't honest. And my son was born in England. He's got an English passport. My husband's English. Anyway, where was I? That's recorded on TV. Now I'm a little nervous. But he was this very charming person all the same, even though he was really quite eccentric. And when he was also a very young student, about 6 years after Gödel did his most important work, Turing dovetailed with another big idea. And we'll talk about their limit ideas and how it led to things like machines that might think one day, how it led to different ideas on the mind and artificial intelligence. We'll just touch on these things. What else do I have to tell you about them before I go on? I should also mention that Gödel, being this great genius, this brilliant logician, the most important logician since Aristotle, you know, for centuries there had not been a mind like this in logic, and was also a paranoid schizophrenic. This was a deeply troubled person. He was in and out of mental institutions. I mean, they weren't really mental institutions. They were sort of sanatoria. They were in Europe, they're more mildly known. They're not so severe as in America. And but he did have several nervous breakdowns and committed himself willingly more than once in his life. And he was also a severe hypochondriac and would often regulate his diet so rigidly that his weight fell below 100 pounds. So he was a very troubled person, which is why they make for great stories, yes? It's why they make for great stories. So, well, actually, before I flick to that, no, I've done it, here we are. I wanted to tell you why these people gripped me. I am not really a mathematician. I'm a mathematical physicist. It's a little different. I use math. I love math. I'm enamored of it. But I don't really operate at the levels of proof. So I don't really prove that 1 + 1 = 2. There is a proof of it. It takes like 2 volumes. I'm not kidding. It's outrageous where you find the proof of 1 + 1 = 2. That's not really the level at which I operate. I'm happy to accept that and to deal with number theory and topology and very beautiful branches of mathematics. But I was drawn to these mathematicians because they said something that kind of terrified me. They said there can be no mathematical theory of everything. And that really haunted me because I work on the idea that there could be a physical theory of everything. It's falling slightly off the page. And if you've come to these lectures before, I'm sure you've heard people talk about things like string theory or quantum gravity. And there's a lot of work at Perimeter being done on quantum gravity, the attempt to find really that magical theory of everything, the hope that's been there since Einstein. So since Einstein, we've had this great ambition for the theory of everything, that one mathematical sentence which would literally explain not only all of physics, but everything in the universe, because everything in the universe reduces to physics. I mean, this is the great ambition. And it's something that's very seriously on the table now and that people either feel they're close to or far from, but that's the dialogue that's going on in physics. And I've worked on not the theory of everything directly, but I've kind of come in from cosmology to look at where it might show up and other implications. So I've been very interested in things like, is the universe infinite or is it finite? Because I believe a theory of everything will tell us that. And I've worked on things like the Big Bang, because a theory of everything has to tell us how the universe was created. And I've worked on theories of black holes, because at the cores of black holes is where we would see a theory of everything really acting out. And so here is my life's work. And at the same time, I have to remember there are these great mathematicians who, at a time when all of mathematics believed there would be a mathematical theory of everything, were blown away because they heard from Gödel and Turing that there is not and there will never be. It's not that we're not clever enough to find a mathematical theory of everything. It's that certain numbers and certain mathematical propositions are forever beyond our understanding. They're beyond mathematics' understanding. This is really a wild idea. So we'll talk about that idea. And so that's why they kind of always gnawed at me and started to haunt me, and I started to think more about their work and their ideas. So they proved that there is no mathematical theory of everything. Another way of saying that is that they proved that there are some truths that can never be proven to be true. And that's a real twister. There's going to come a point in this lecture where you're going to go, I still don't get it, you know? And that's okay. Don't blame me. Don't blame yourselves. This stuff is hard. It takes years. There are courses taught on this. You spend a whole year struggling, laboring, taking this course, and you still come out saying, I don't quite get it. But we'll talk about a parallel idea in epistemology that's a little easier to get, and then I'll argue for you how it worked in mathematics. But they prove there are some truths that can never be proven to be true, and that even mathematical truth can be elusive. This is not metaphorical, like, you know, truth is relative, so your side of the story and your boyfriend's side of the story are equally good. You know, it's not really what we're talking about in terms of the elusiveness of truth. We're talking about a proof that there are true propositions that we can never really know. Okay, I just gleaned this from a web, but here's a picture of a Viennese coffee house. I pulled this down because Gödel, in 1931, when he was working on these ideas, hung out with a group of philosophers and scientists and mathematicians in a cafe. This is not the actual cafe. I had trouble getting that picture, but it looked like this one, very similar. And this is a Viennese cafe. And they would talk every Thursday night about reality, metaphysics, which they hated, religion, which they hated, politics, which they hated. And all that they loved was mathematics and logic. This was going to save them. You have to understand, this is also post-World War I, which is a very traumatic time for Europe. And this idea that the purity of mathematics and the completeness, the wholeness of mathematics was going to save them somehow. It was going to, you know, lift them up. Maybe I'm being a little too emotional, but I think it's fair to say. And there was a call by the greatest mathematician at the time, David Hilbert, that the mathematical community rise up and prove once and for all that indeed mathematics is complete. That is to say, there is a mathematical theory of everything, to prove that all mathematical theorems could be proven to be true in mathematics. It's not that outrageous a claim. And he wasn't saying prove them all. There surely is an infinite list. It will never be completed, but just prove that it could in principle be done. And so this was almost, I mean, there was a little bit of argument. Most people believed that the day would come when it would be settled. But there was this funny thing hanging around as they talked about philosophy and mathematics and science, and that was an ancient paradox called the liar's paradox. The liar's paradox is due to Epimenides, but it has several ways of being expressed. But one is that the Cretan says all Cretans are liars. So the Cretan's lying to you, saying he's a liar. So is he lying or is he not lying? It's sort of one of those funny expressions. The way I prefer to think about it is to say, this is a lie. Okay, the liar declares, this is a lie. If I think about this proposition, I can't decide if it's true or false. I cannot decide if this is true or false. Let's just think about this for a second. If it's true that it's a lie, then it's a lie, right? If it's true that it's a lie, then it is a lie. But if it's a lie, doesn't that mean it's false? I mean, to be a lie isn't the same as being false. So if it's true, it must be false. And here I have this paradox, this undecidable paradox. If it's true, it must be false. So if I try it the other way around, if I say, well, no, it's false, then it's not a lie. And if it's not a lie, doesn't not being a lie mean that something is true? So if it's not a lie, then it's true. But I just said I determined that it was true by deciding in the beginning that it was false. Okay. Anyone get this? Anyone want to admit they don't get this? That's right. So, you know, the liar's paradox actually looms large in my book because it's one of the things that inspired me to try fiction. You know, the narrator's lying to you. There's this famous thing, and a bit of a digression here, but a famous thing in literary fiction where of the unreliable narrator, the narrator who you think is telling you the truth, and somewhere along the way you start to suspect is lying to you a bit. And I think that's true of all narrators. I mean, even in pure nonfiction, there's a narrator there who's trying to tell you some story. And so the idea of fictionalizing the tale of people who worked on these ideas starts with the idea of the liar's paradox. Okay, so this is undecidable. I really don't know if it's true or false. Now, there was there was another lunatic hanging around at the time, which I'll tell you about in a second. But a lot of people believe that this would just be true in epistemology, or this would just be true, in other words, in language, and it wasn't real. It didn't really exist. It wasn't a meaningful problem. So here comes Ludwig Wittgenstein. Ludwig Wittgenstein is the greatest philosopher of the 20th century, and even if you don't like him, you gotta love him. He had crazy hair, he was ill-tempered, he was from the wealthiest family in all of Europe. I mean, this was an extravagantly wealthy family. I can't even gauge their material wealth. They lived in a palace, literally a palace. He kept trying to shed his wealth. He would do stoic things. He would go live in Norway in some rural area and teach grammar to school children, and then he would try to give away all his money, but there was so much of it. And he would, you know, he had 8 brothers and sisters, and 3 of them committed suicide. I mean, it was an astounding personal story for Ludwig Wittgenstein alone. And I bring him here because the circle, the Vienna circle that sat around those coffee houses every Thursday night, they were fixated with Wittgenstein. They loved him. They read his book, his first book, the Tractatus, line by line. It took them over a year to sit there and read this book line by line. And he would make these beautiful declarations about what was true, what was real, what was logical. It was written almost in this stochastic sort of way. It was just proclamations with no explanation. And yet he was very influential in the Vienna circle. And one of his arguments was, this is a problem with language, that to say the liar's paradox can't be decided isn't that big a deal, because it's really meaningless, actually. And only meaningful questions are worth talking about. And mathematics is something that has only meaningful questions. In something like mathematics, like pure logic, you would never have anything like the liar's paradox. This was really central, that you would never have the liar's paradox in mathematics. That mathematics would be free of these kinds of undecidable tangles. The belief and the hope was that mathematics was complete. Again, the idea that it had a theory of everything, and there would never be a statement like this, which lies in some sense outside of mathematics' ability to determine if it's true or false. Okay? If you have a statement where you can't determine if it's true or false, and it lies outside of the reach of mathematics, then mathematics is not complete. It can't touch everything. It can't prove all true things. And so this seems fair enough to require. So they did. But it turns out to be wrong. And this is where Gödel showed up. He showed that mathematics was not complete, that there were these undecidable statements. And the way he did it was to think about the liar's paradox. He said, in ordinary language, there's something like the liar's paradox. You say, this is a lie. And what's interesting about it is it refers to itself. That's absolutely essential. It refers to itself, and then it makes an unsolvable claim about itself. And so that's what he tried to do. It took him 46 preliminary logical definitions, an incredible, incredible leap of intuition, true stroke of genius to do it. But what he did is he constructed the mathematical equivalent to the statement, this is unprovable. So it's the mathematical equivalent to the idea that this is unprovable. And here's where we get to the point where you shouldn't blame me or yourselves, but this is going to be, you know, the sticky point in trying to think this through. And I have to apologize, because it does take a year's worth, I think, of a lecture to really get your head around this. So I'll just kind of give you a sketch of what he did. He started with the idea that you could have this declaration, this is unprovable. But what does proof really mean? In mathematics, proof means you start with some axioms. So let's just think about arithmetic, which is the theory of mathematics for numbers, for regular numbers, ordinary numbers. The theory that proves that 1 + 1 = 2 and 2 + 2 = 4, that proves that 4 squared is 16. And it's really basic arithmetic. You start with the axioms of arithmetic, let's say, and to have a mathematical proof, you take the rules to transform those axioms step by step. There are operations like addition, there's rules of inference, subtraction, multiplication, division, and rules of inference, and those will lead you to the theorems of arithmetic. And surely there are an infinite number of theorems of arithmetic, and all of that's fine. But when he said there's no proof, he meant if I started with the axioms of arithmetic, and I transformed them rule by rule, I would never find the mathematical equivalent of this statement as a theorem of mathematics. And I'm just going to show it to you here. And I'm not going to prove it. But what he essentially did is he coded, this is really, I mean, his proof really is many, many, many pages long. But he coded this statement into numbers. First, he wrote it down as an expression. He said something like, there is a number that belongs to this class of all numbers that can't be proven. And then he showed that that very number corresponded to the theorem itself. And he did something very magical, which was to code everything, map everything into numbers. So everything became purely numerical. It was really a kind of coding. And this was interesting with respect to his strange relationship with Alan Turing, because Alan Turing became the greatest code breaker, and yet was very influenced by Gödel's ideas on mathematical coding. And so Gödel really has a mathematical proof to show that there are statements that make claims about themselves that cannot be solved within mathematics. Okay? And so therefore, mathematics cannot be a theory of everything, because even if I can know everything about ordinary numbers that I'm used to dealing with every day, numbers like pi and like 5 and like 7.672, there's at least this one relationship among numbers. It's a strange one, granted, not one I run into every day, but it's one that I can never prove is true or false. And yet something very strange can happen. Since it claims about itself that it cannot be proven, I can step outside of mathematics, I can look at it from the corner of my eye, and I can realize, well, it's true, isn't it? I mean, it's making a true claim. An intuitive notion of truth emerges. And this is one of the very strange things about it. I can see it's true, but I can't actually prove that it's true. And again, this partly inspires the idea of trying to deal with a fictionalized form. Some truths you can't reach by following logical step after logical step. Sometimes you step outside. And so that was part of the idea of stepping outside of biography or stepping outside of nonfiction. And Alan Turing comes along. Alan Turing is a little bit younger than Kurt Gödel. And he's very influenced by these ideas when he hears it. He knows a big idea when he hears it. And Alan Turing's, in a strange way, a more practical person, kind of a less philosophical person. And there's one issue that's still remaining on this whole question of the theory of everything in mathematics, and that is, let's say I just throw a theorem or a mathematical proposition at you. Can you tell me whether or not it could, in principle, be decided if it was true or false? Not prove that it's true or false, but just tell me in principle, is there some systematic formal way to know that it can be decided? And actually, Turing also answers this by saying no. And he does something incredibly ingenious in the process. He invents a machine. It's just a thought experiment. He begins by imagining a kind of typewriter, an old typewriter, and he says, suppose I built a typewriter that could read some input, and I make a very simple machine. So it reads a tape, let's say, and maybe the tape has zeros and ones on it. So it codes information in zeros and ones. This is starting to sound familiar. And this machine would read these zeros and ones, and for a zero, it would do some very simple thing, like maybe it would change configuration and then move on to the next square. And if it saw a one, maybe it would print a one, and then it would move on to the next square. And it would have these very sort of simple set of operations. And what he realized by thinking about this machine was that he could get this machine to add, and he could get it to multiply, and he could get it to divide, and he could get it to do just about any kind of mathematical operation that a human, what he called computer, could do, a person who computes. He said anything a human computer could do in mathematics, as long as it's following the logical transformation rules of mathematics, any theorem a human computer could prove, this machine could prove. And it took a long time, I think, for people, not that long, but a while for people to accept that this was really a very general machine, that in some sense it was universal. And they were eventually coined as Turing machines. And what he realized in making these computers, I'm not going to explain this in depth, I'm just going to mention it, is that even though we have familiar numbers, like 1 and 2 and 5 and pi and 7.672, whatever they are, there's an infinite list of numbers about which we know nothing, about which we essentially know nothing. And he proved this by saying even if he tried to get his machine to compute all of the infinite list of digits after, let's say, the decimal point of one of these numbers, it would never halt. It would never stop computing. It would have to compute forever. And so in principle, there's this list of infinitely long numbers about which we can really know nothing. It doesn't mean that every number that's infinitely long we can know nothing about, because that's not really true about pi. We have a way of computing pi, but there's a list of numbers about which we have no means for computing them. They're essentially random. They're random numbers. They're numbers whose properties might as well be up to the toss of a coin. Another way of saying it, and this came later, somebody named Gregory Chaitin, who's a mathematician today, who's done amazing work on this. Another way of saying it is to say that the complexity of the number, it's so random, so complex, that it exceeds the complexity of any, that no machine could possibly compute it and be less complex. It's another way of saying it. That the machine would have to be as complex as the number itself. These were called uncomputable numbers. And it was, again, a really severe blow to the mathematics community. It means that there's an infinite list of numbers about which we know nothing. But what's fascinating is what emerged from this is that Turing realized he could mechanize thought, that he could make a machine that could think. And he really meant think. And it became the thought experiment behind the computer. So Alan Turing invents the computer. Now, the idea of limits leading to discovery is not, it's not the first time in the history of science and math that this has happened. And in fact, there's two other examples that happened right around the same time that are absolutely fascinating. So I'm just going to mention that this was not the only limit theorem that led to a great discovery. There was the limit of the speed of light and the theory of relativity. When Albert Einstein could not get a job because his teachers thought he was a lazy dog, was the quote. So when you're feeling bad about your studies, just remember, his professor called him a lazy dog. It doesn't mean that if you're a lazy dog, you're going to discover relativity, of course. It doesn't always work that way. He also said about himself, he said, you know, when I was a student, I was no Einstein. So it always takes a second to respond to that joke. And so here he was, a patent clerk who couldn't get a job, and he invents special relativity by thinking that the speed of light is a fundamental limit. And if the speed of light is a fundamental limit, he realized he would have to make space and time relative. That if my clocks and my rulers measure space and time relative as I move past you, we could actually measure the speed of light the same. This was something he realized. So if we kept the speed of light the same between us as I came flying past you, but I gave up the nature of space and time, he realized he had a consistent theory that solved some problems at the time and invents relativity. Remarkable. There was also Heisenberg, who was the great physicist who realized that we could never know everything about the fundamental nature of matter, that even if I tried to measure the location of an electron, a particle that orbits around the nucleus, incredibly precisely, and I tried to pin it down incredibly precisely, there's a fundamental limit to how well I could ever define its location. And it's not a statement that my experiment's not really good enough. It seemed to say something about reality. And it led to the idea of quantum, or didn't lead to, but it was one of the big ideas in developing quantum mechanics. And one of the strangest things about quantum mechanics is that there's something about the reality itself that is genuinely slippery. There's something about the meaning of the electron existing in a location of space that actually becomes fundamentally slippery. So this is another deep idea. And here we have the limits of mathematics leading to the idea of computers, and beyond computers, the great aspiration of artificial intelligence. And Turing really believed that we would have artificial intelligence. And of course, this is the great project for computer scientists still today. And I should say that Turing even more said, not only can I build a machine that thinks, he said, you know, I really am a machine that thinks. He really declared that we were biological machines. It wasn't just that he could build a mechanical, electromechanical computer, but that human beings were really biological machines executing a list of tasks. And so he came to this, you know, what some people find a very chilling conclusion, that we are essentially biological machines. And I think another thing that's very fascinating about these two characters is here they come together on this notion of mathematical truth. So they converge on this very deep idea of mathematical truth. But they converge on this, and then they diverge totally in their belief system. So people are often asking me, don't you think that you can get the mathematics to make an argument about a certain belief? And I think this is evidence for why you can't, because here you have the two greatest minds coming together and having a point of contact in this beautiful world of kind of mathematical truth, and then believing totally opposite things, diverging totally. So Gödel believes in transmigration of the soul. He was very serious about this. He believed that there was a Platonic reality, which is to say a mathematically pure reality beyond this one. And it was more real in some sense than the ordinary world that he lived in, which he was very suspicious of and very paranoid about. And that by thinking, he was touching this other reality. And that each time his soul was reincarnated, he would migrate to this Platonic realm. So if you believe that his theorems have proved that, that's what you have in store for you. Turing, by contrast, was a kind of religious adolescent, and he was struggling with his religion and struggling with his faith because he knew that there were flaws and problems he couldn't quite figure out in terms of allowing for free will, or the issue of the soul was very confusing to him. But he wrote letters about this to friends about the soul. And I think when he had his mathematical epiphany in his 20s, he became a firm materialist. He abandoned his religious beliefs entirely and came to the conclusion that not only doesn't our soul migrate to a Platonic reality, but that we have no soul, that we are really soulless biological machines, and that when computers think, they'll be as alive and as conscious as we are. So these are obviously totally divergent views, and Gödel, I think, was quite haunted by Turing's conclusion. Here's another picture of Kurt Gödel. I could have gotten a better resolution, but I thought the graininess added a kind of a nice quality. And so here I was, a student of physics and mathematical physics for many years, and I knew about their theorems, but it was a long time before I knew some of these belief systems that they had. And then there came another shocking bit of information that I hadn't known about, and that was that Kurt Gödel starved himself to death. I find this an absolutely shocking fact. He was a severe hypochondriac. It was almost like there were these two opposing forces, one defending his life so aggressively and the other actually being quite suicidal. And there was this constant push and pull between the two, this constant tension. So he many times in his life became so ill and so thin that his weight was 75, 85 pounds, 100 pounds. And his wife, Adele, who was 10 years older than him and really mothered him back to life, would have to feed him spoonful by spoonful to keep him alive. And it wasn't until Adele really fell ill herself that she wasn't there to care for him. And that was really the end for Kurt Gödel. He starved himself to death. He was 65 pounds when he died. Very shocking. He feared that the government was poisoning him. And so that's why he refused to eat his food. And strange, he was really logical to the end, though, in a strange way. He didn't think, purple elephants with tutus were flying in the windows. I mean, he didn't have those kinds of strange delusions. He had very rational delusions. I mean, even if they were wrong, it was very logically executed in his mind. And in a way, to abstain from eating food was, in a strange, peculiar sense, logical. And Alan Turing, by almost perfect inversion and perfect contrast, ate a poison apple and committed suicide. Turing's favorite movie was Snow White. I don't know. And it was Gödel's, too, and I don't know why that's the case. Apparently, it was Gödel's favorite movie, too, Snow White. And he used to go around singing, "Dip the apple in the brew, let the sleeping death seep through." But his life took a turn when he admitted to the police. His house had been burgled in the 50s. This was after the war and after he had been a great hero, but nobody knew he was a hero because it was still being kept secret to protect state secrets. And so he was considered an ordinary citizen. I mean, people didn't really understand that this man had really turned the tide in the favor of Britain during the war. I didn't talk much about his code breaking, but he was absolutely essential in turning the direction of the war. And yet he was sort of an ordinary citizen at this time in the 50s, and his house had been burgled. And when he reported it to the police, he admitted to having a homosexual affair with one of the suspects. And it was illegal to be gay in England, as it was, I think, in America. Though not completely sure about that. And they arrested him. And he was tried and convicted of homosexuality and homosexual activity and was given a sentence that was either prison or hormonal castration, chemical castration. And they gave him hormone treatments for 2 years. He became obese and depressed and eventually committed suicide by eating a poison apple. So I brought you here to tell you these happy tales. But here is why, it makes for great fiction. Do I have my fiction slide? Here's why it makes for great fiction. Not because it's terrible and tragic, but because there's something about, I guess it is tragic, something about the tragic hero that I think speaks to our imagination, which is there is something about these men that makes them great, and there's sometimes the same exact character that is their downfall. I had a review, somebody wrote a review of my book in the New York Times, and they called it obsessive genius disorder, and I thought that's a good way of saying it. They had obsessive genius disorder. And so they had this beautiful heroism and these phenomenal accomplishments and this incredible ability to see a kind of fundamental truth and yet an inability to recognize the mundane, ordinary truths of their own lives. And again, this led to the idea of trying to do something fictionalized. So I won't press that too much. Let me just check the time. So I thought, if you'd indulge me, I'd try reading from the book. I don't usually do this, but since this is a novel, it seemed like a fair thing to try to do. If anyone objects, you could try to tackle me off the stage. Wasn't there a comedian who opened up The Great Gatsby? It was Andy Kaufman, and just started reading in monotone from page one. I won't do that. So let me read a scene. This is in the coffee houses in 1931. And it's a scene about Kurt Gödel. The scene is a coffee house. The Cafe Josephinum is a smell first, a stinging smell of roasted Turkish beans too heavy to waft on air, and so waiting instead for the more powerful current of steam blown off the surface of boiling saucers. The cafe appears in the brain as this delicious, muddy scent first, awaking a memory of the shifting room of mirrors second, the memory nearly as energetic as the actual sight of the room, which appears in the mind only third. The coffee is a fuel to power ideas, a fuel for the anxious hope that the harvest of art and words and logic will be the richest ever, because only the most fecund season will see them through the siege of this terrible winter and the siege of that terrible war. Names are made and forgotten. Famous lines are penned, along with not so famous lines. Artists pay their debt with work that colors some walls, while others fall into an appealing decrepitude. Outside, Vienna deteriorates and rejuvenates in swatches, a motley, poorly tended garden. From out here, the windows of the coffee house seem to project the crowd inside from the elements and the tedium of any given day. Inside, they laugh and smoke and shout and argue and stare and whistle as the milky brew hardens to lace along the lip of their cups. I was just skipping ahead a bit. Gödel is taciturn, alone even in a crowd. Back against the wall, looking out as though in the cinema, he is reticent but not unlikable. The attention with which his smooth hair, brushed back over his head away from his face, is creamed and tended, hints at his strongest interest next to mathematics, namely women. His efforts often come to fruition, only adding to his mystery for a great many of the mathematicians around him. And while he's been known to show off a girlfriend or two, he keeps his real love a secret, his bruised apple, his sweet Adele. There's something sweet about his face, too, hidden as it is behind thick-rimmed goggle glasses, inverted binoculars, so that those who are drawn into a discussion of mathematics with him feel as though they are peering into a blurry, distant horizon. The completely round black frames with thick nosepiece have the effect of accentuating his eyes or replacing them with cartoon orbs, a physical manifestation of great metaphorical vision. They leave the suggestion with anyone looking in that all emphasis should be placed there on those sad windows, or, more important, on the vast intellectual world that lies just beyond the focus of the binocular lenses. He speaks only when spoken to, and then only about mathematics. But his responses are stark and beautiful, and the very few able to connect with him feel they have discovered an invaluable treasure. His sparse counsel is sought after and esteemed. This is a youth of impressive talent and intimidating weakness, strength. This is also a youth of impressive strangeness and intimidating weakness. Maybe he has no more weaknesses than the rest of us harbor, but his all seems so extreme. Hypochondria, paranoia, schizophrenia. They're even more pronounced when laid alongside his great mental strengths. They appear as huge black voids, chunks taken out of an intensely shining star. He is still all potential, the potential to be great, the potential to be mad. He will achieve both magnificently. Everyone gathered on this Thursday, the rotating numbers accounting for some three dozen, believe in their very hearts that mathematics is unassailable. Gödel has come tonight to shatter their belief until all that is left are convincing pieces that when assembled erect a powerful monument to mathematics, but not an unassailable one. Gödel will prove that some truths live outside of logic and that we can't get there from here. Some people who are quick to distrust mathematics, claim they knew all along that some truths are beyond math, but they just didn't. They didn't know it. They didn't prove it. Gödel didn't believe that truth would elude us. He proved it would. He didn't invent a myth to conform to his prejudice of the world. He discovered his theorem as surely as if it was a rock he had dug up from the ground. He could pass it around the table, and it would be as real as that rock. If anyone cared to, they could dig it up where he buried it and find it just the same. Look for it, and you'll find it where he said it is, just off center from where you're staring. There are faint stars in the night sky that you can see, but burn too weakly. There are faint stars in the night sky that you can see, but only if you look to the side of where they shine. They burn too weakly or are too far away to be seen directly, even if you stare. But you can see them out of the corner of your eye because the cells on the periphery of your retina are more sensitive to light. Maybe truth is just like that. You can see it, but only out of the corner of your eye. I want to try one other passage. Actually, let me tell you a little bit about Alan again before I do this. So even though he was a declared openly gay person, he was engaged to be married, which was a strange thing. When he was at Bletchley Park working on code breaking, he was involved with another one of the cryptanalysts. I think that's all I really have to say, actually. And then I'll read this passage. Her name was Joan. Alan is engaged to be married to a woman. She has been his best friend since he was drafted by the government code in cipher school, and this counts for something. He remembers her in Hut 8, bent over meaningless groups of letters, her neck tense and horizontal, over the table, hoping some pattern might stick in her eye. His clearest memory of her begins that morning after the woods, when he wakes with this idea nearly formed, a technicolor vision. He makes it to Hut 8 at noon with a gas mask strapped to his face and his sagging pants held up by a piece of string. Joan watches him the morning after he buried his treasure in the woods, and everything else seems far away. The smell of the London bombs, the creak and drone of the U-boat stifled by the ocean, the cricketing of machines. It all goes quiet, even the click of the keys of the Enigma machine. She likes his face most when it is still as a photograph. The way his dark eyebrows accentuate his eyes does not look typically English, and maybe this detracts people from noticing how handsome the accent can be, especially when he isn't moving or talking or laughing. She watches Alan unlock the tea mug he ludicrously keeps chained to a radiator, as though someone could possibly mistake the owner for someone other than Alan, as though any of the other cryptographers would put their lips to his personal cup, the inside walls horribly stained a rusty brown from the tea he always overbrews. As he kneels at the radiator to unlock his possession, his heels splay open, and she sees where he tried to wash the mud from the seat of his pants. As she looks along his leg, she can't help but marvel that even as he washed the cuffs and hem, probably in the sink of his room this morning, he didn't notice the two leaves matted with gray mud into the seat of his trousers. Alan and his schemes, in addition to the mug secured by steel links to the heating apparatus and his plan for the safe hiding of silver bullion, there is a government-issued gas mask he wears to defend himself against allergies. There is the alarm clock he tied to his waist to time his run from Bletchley nearly all the way to London, as well as the razor blades he wants to sell out of a suitcase if times get tough and he is unable to secure a job because he is unable to reveal the nature of his service to his country. There are his machines that mechanize thought and crack code. And she, too, is she one of his schemes, to have a home and a wife, to wash his clothes, bear his children, tend his house. He occasionally surprises her with these conventional social ideas, preserved relics of his family background. Maybe they survive despite all of his other eccentricities because they are so utterly irrelevant to his actual life. Okay, I'm going to stop there. See, part science talk, part reading. I was going to read a passage from Wittgenstein, but I think it's too much, and I can't actually see that well right here. But Wittgenstein loomed in and out in their lives. I just close by saying that even though Gödel and Turing never actually met in person, I think this is an interesting thing. They knew of each other, and they were very influenced each other. They never actually met in person. The one time when Turing went to study at Princeton, which is where Gödel had settled to work on his mathematics for the last many years, decades of his life, during that one period of time, Gödel had a nervous breakdown and fled back to Europe. And when Turing talked about it, said it was his greatest regret that he never met Gödel at that time. And Wittgenstein was one of these characters that moved in and out of their lives, that went from Vienna and emigrated from Vienna to Cambridge, where he was engaged in a kind of mathematical dialogue then with Turing. So he provides this kind of strange link in the world of ideas between them. So let me just close by saying that even though my claim is that mathematical truth is elusive, and I wrote a sort of fictionalized story, doesn't mean that all truths are elusive. But I think it's a profound thing to wonder if in this very limit of mathematics, as we're discovering greater things about our abilities in things like artificial intelligence and machines that might think, we're also at the same time confessing some limit in our own ability. And I think that that's a very profound thing that's happened many times before. Even if you think of Copernicus, this big revolution we had, this big moment of huge advance scientifically, it was made by realizing we are not at the center of the cosmos. It was made by making that admission. We do not, the celestial bodies do not orbit us. We orbit the sun. The sun is not at the center of the galaxy. The galaxy is not at the center of the universe. And I think something similar recurrently happens, and I think that's what makes it such a beautiful story, that we are simultaneously limited even as we are doing things that make us great. Thank you.
So I have a few questions based upon my reading of the book and your talk this evening, and I'm going to basically see if I can leverage the fact that you are not only an author but a scientist, and you have written not only a work of fiction but a work of fiction and nonfiction. So I'll see if I can ask questions from all across that milieu. You talked a little bit, in fact, the passage that you read of the Viennese cafe and Gödel attending, and my understanding is that the scene that you depicted, so correct me if I'm wrong, but the scene that you depicted where he came out, as it were, with the incompleteness theorem during that meeting of the Vienna Circle, that is probably fiction, right? Or do you have any evidence that he actually did that during that? I know he came out during a conference and so forth.
Yes,
and said
that's
that.
True.
Did he, so was that fiction or was that nonfiction?
Well, it's a good question. So the importance of the Vienna Circle on his life is true. He definitely participated, although he never agreed with them. He almost always disagreed with them. So that he sort of related to them in opposition. And I think he was very it gave him a lot of structure in a world that he didn't understand and in a world that he didn't trust. And so that, although it's fictionalized in the telling, is pretty true. But it's unclear whether or not there was that moment. So no, that was totally fictionalized. That there was a moment when he came to them and said, look, this is how it works. I think there was a moment, as you said, at a famous conference where he did stand up and presented his paper. And in fact, the greatest mathematicians of the time were there. And Hilbert was there, the great mathematician who made this call to prove that there was a mathematical theory of everything. He was more or less ignored.
Except for von Neumann, right?
Except for von Neumann, exactly, yeah.
So that's interesting. Just for the benefit of people, you alluded to this in your talk about the Vienna Circle, but and you talked about how they spurned religion and how they spurned metaphysics, and in fact, their whole modus operandi, the whole motivation for the circle was to get away, clear through the muddle, get away from all this silly business that couldn't be proven. And as you said, they took Wittgenstein as their role model, that which we cannot talk about with any clarity or rigor, we should be silent about, and try to put everything in the scientific footing.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And so here you have Kurt Gödel, who, as you say, is somebody who is quite different, who has these metaphysical tendencies,
right.
Who's a Platonist, who is, as you say, completely opposed to the whole operation. And one of the things which has always puzzled me, certainly was, I remembered it again in your book, but it has always puzzled me, is why on earth was he hanging around these guys? Why did he want to hang around them? Because he was a very laconic person, as you mentioned. He didn't talk very much.
Yeah.
Why was he there, and why did they want him there? Do you have any understanding as to?
Well, I think it was clear. He was brought into the circle by a professor who was advising him, essentially. It was very clear that he was exceptionally talented. I think that was clear, and that's why they wanted him there. And the people who could join the circle were handpicked for their ability and their talent. So it's clear that that's why he was invited. Why did he go? I mean, I think that's part of why I had to imagine his reasons for going, because I don't have a documented reason. I mean, I wondered the same thing myself, and I invented this kind of relationship he might have had with Moritz Schlick, who was the founder of the circle and also had a fascinating story, which is told. But I don't really know that that's true, and I think he went because mathematics was his only link to reality, and at least to discuss it, even to argue about it, or even to stand in opposition to it, was at least to be relating to the world in a way that he had some confidence.
So two more questions. One is about Wittgenstein, because you always have to ask something about Wittgenstein. So you mentioned, again in your book, there's the meeting between Wittgenstein and Turing when they're in Cambridge, and they seem to be a little bit at a disconnect. And of course, as you mentioned, Wittgenstein was this remarkably charismatic figure who had all these disciples who went around chasing after him and hanging on every word. But one of the things that, again, historically has and I'm not terribly knowledgeable about this, but has always somewhat shocked me, is here is Wittgenstein saying, well, the liar's paradox is just muddled wording, and it's all just a big mess, and we don't, if we don't really understand something, it's just playing games with words, and we don't really understand it, so we should basically just shut up, and it doesn't really mean anything. I'm paraphrasing, of course. It's very much like that in German, actually.
That's the modern translation.
And so then here's this guy, Gödel, who comes up with this remarkable, breathtaking proof that clearly says, well, no, that's just wrong. And so is there ever a point, at least that you know and that you've discovered in your historical search through all this, that Wittgenstein says, oops, that's wrong, or other people start saying, well, why are we listening to this guy? Yeah. Because Gödel came along and showed this. I mean, is there any way in which there's in your view, a justifiable comeback to that claim, or is there any acknowledgement on Wittgenstein's part?
Well, I don't think Wittgenstein ever acknowledged it, but it was sort of popularly believed that Wittgenstein just missed the point and was not a great logician and just didn't get it and didn't get what Gödel was trying to say and never got it. But even recently, there are scholars who are arguing that actually Wittgenstein got it more than people said. And if you look at, he did write about Gödel's theorems. He did write some responses. And If you look very carefully, he's doing a classic Wittgensteinian type of thing, which is to dwell on the language and to say, but what do you really mean by true? And he's not actually being that trite. And this idea of an intuitive truth is hard to define. So what do I mean to say that the claim is true? And so he can get you kind of confused, as Wittgenstein was fantastic at getting people kind of confused. So I can only tell you the popularly held belief is that he never got it, but there are people who think actually if we look closer, we'll see that there was something going on there. But I just want to add that even though the Vienna Circle, which was devoted to logic and rationalism and really looked to Wittgenstein for a kind of lead on this, were going to be sadly disillusioned when they realized that indeed he was a mystic. The man was a mystic. He was not this totally rational, logical person that they took him to be. And sometimes when you read that passage, what we cannot talk about, we must pass over in silence, you could look at it as saying what he really meant was that you should have a mystical experience of the beauty of this mystical world, which is something we cannot talk about, and we should pass over right. In silence. So he was an enigma.
So maybe even to paraphrase, so when he was trying to ask this deeper question of what do you mean by truth, maybe he was invoking the Clinton defense to some extent.
That I'm not going to answer.
let me ask you one other question, and I'll switch back to your role as an author and as an author of fiction. So, as you mentioned, Turing and Gödel never met. It just so happened when Turing went to Princeton, Gödel had gone back to Vienna. But what do you think would have happened had they met? Mm-hmm. What sort of dialogue do you imagine would they have had? And how would that have played out in your view?
Well, I thought about putting them in a room together. But I decided against it. So let me just mention in the process of how you make choices in fiction, because writing fiction, unlike nonfiction, well, it's also in nonfiction, but especially in fiction, it's all about your choices. It's all about what you choose to include and what you choose to exclude. And I felt that what I really wanted to do was try to make something as close to the facts as possible, and yet to show that the truth of their lives does not emerge as a theorem in a way. And so I really wanted to stick tight to the facts. Even if I could imagine the scenes and embellish on that, I decided not to do anything radical, like put them in a room together. And so I think it was an important choice to stick to. But I did wonder how that conversation would go. And I gave this lofty answer, but it didn't work that well for me. It wasn't clear to me that they would have understood each other. I mean, there was clear that they would have understood each other in the world of logic, but it wasn't clear that they would have understood each other outside of it. I mean, Gödel had conversations with many great mathematicians, and there was often a moment where he just seemed so peculiar, otherworldly. Many people described him as so otherworldly. So to discuss anything outside of logic, I'm not sure if that conversation would have been any more fruitful than it was with anyone else. And the conversation within logic, though, could have been very interesting. What would they have said about artificial intelligence in such early days? I mean, that's fascinating to wonder. Would Gödel really have pressed Turing to think about his thesis on the mind? And I doubt Turing could have persuaded Gödel to believe otherwise, but what could they have come up with? And it's, you know, it is fascinating to wonder.
Well, I think our conversation has been very fruitful, and I'd like to thank
you
very much for a wonderful evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.